Einen wunderschönen guten Tag, verehrte Zuhörer und Zuhörerinnen da draußen und willkommen zu einer weiteren Sonderepisode von Let's Talk Guitar, dem deutschsprachigen Podcast über die wunderbare Welt der Gitarre und der Musik. Heute versammelt in den heiligen Hallen der Podcast-Schmiedereien bin erstmal nur ich, der liebe Justin. Denn ich habe gestern ein echt interessantes Interview mit niemand Geringerem geführt als Jordan Ruders, Keyboard-Virtuose und Keyboard Maestro der Band Dream Theater. Und wir haben über echt interessante Dinge gesprochen, wie man am besten übt, wie es ist, in der Band wie Dream Theater zu spielen und ganz viele andere Dinge. Und Fabian und ich haben gesagt, hey, weil dieses Interview wird es auf YouTube in voller Länge geben. Aber Fabian und ich dachten uns, hey, für die Leute, die lieber solch längere Sachen als Podcast hören, warum das nicht Ganze nicht einfach auf Let's Talk Guitar hochladen? Deswegen werde ich das jetzt hier tun. Und ihr werdet das hoffentlich alle hören. Denn da gibt's echt interessante Sachen raus zu mitzunehmen und zu lernen. Aber so wie das halt ist, ist Jordan Ruders ein Amerikaner und kann, glaube ich, eher weniger Deutsch sprechen. Deswegen ist das komplette Interview natürlich auf Englisch, weil jetzt fast eine Stunde hingehen und alles versuchen zu übersetzen. Und ihr wollt ja auch nicht die ganze Zeit meine nervige Stimme irgendwie da hören, wie ich versuche, keine Ahnung was, wie in polnischen alten Filmproduktionen drüber synchronisiere. Das wollt ihr ja auch nicht. Nee. Also, das Ganze ist auf Englisch. Ich rate nichtsdestotrotz, das immer nochmal auf YouTube auch zu schauen, weil es gibt ein, zwei Stellen, da zeigt er halt gerade was mit seinen Fingern etc. Macht schon Sinn, auch auf YouTube zu gucken, aber ja, müsst ihr auch nicht. Die auf Let's Talk Guitar, das reicht vollkommen aus. Nun gut, das ist ja die Sonderepisode. Ich möchte auch gar nicht groß weiter labern. Ich wünsche euch allen ganz, ganz, ganz viel Spaß mit diesem echt coolen Interview. Es war mir eine mega Ehre, mit John zusammen zu reden. Und ja, ansonsten freue ich mich auf die nächste Episode, die wird auch nochmal ganz, 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 ganz toll und wünsche euch soweit noch einen schönen Tag, Morgen, Nachmittag, wie auch immer. Viel Spaß beim Hören, viel Spaß beim Üben. Macht gut! So, welcome to John. Thank you to have you here on my YouTube channel for my YouTube community as well. We want to talk a little bit about the beautiful art of practicing the guitar and making music out of this process of practicing with you today. But first, I want to travel a little back in time with you and a little bit of space, maybe back to the early age of 60s and 70s and in your time in Juilliard. What wonders me a lot when I think about your career and you as a musician is, yeah, how did your daily life look like that back in the day? And was there any conflict between becoming the next piano prodigy and, for example, school or something like that?
Oh, well, good question. So, you know, so I started playing the piano when I was seven with a local teacher. And just a little bit of history. So the local teacher was more of a jazz guy. So he recognized that I had a pretty good ear really fast. And he didn't want to teach me any of the like music notes on the page. All he wanted to do was explore my ear and kind of like enjoy, you know, that. So he started to show me all the chords and maybe the circle of fifths. And next thing I know, I was, you know, improvising and just having fun at the piano. So after about a year of studying with him, what happened was that we had some friends that had come over that knew more about music. And they said to my parents, hey, you know, your child is very talented. He should go to a serious teacher. So that's what happened. We found somebody that prepared me to go to Juilliard. And when I was 9 years old, I went to Juilliard and I studied with a really, really serious teacher. So that started a whole different kind of a life. And really that's all I knew, you know, like everything was about kind of like this piano study, and it was Juilliard, it was serious. And there were other kids like writing operas and, really? You know, that were like 9 years old and doing incredible things. And, so I was practicing a lot, you know, I would practice probably in the really early days, maybe like a couple hours. And, you know, through my time at Juilliard, I was really being programmed to be a concert pianist. Mm. And Yeah, at least every day I would be practicing from 2 to 4 to 5 hours, you know, depending on what was going on, if I had a recital. Very, very, very serious times. And I was really lucky because I had an amazing teacher who, you know, had studied with my teacher was the assistant for a woman whose name was Rosina Levine, who's probably the most famous piano teacher of the last 100 years. So my lineage, with what I learned technically about how to hold my hands, how to develop my technique and independence and, you know, musicality, was really coming from an incredible source. Mm. So I feel really lucky because it kind of gave me this foundation that was really strong, really secure. And I even use, you know, many of those kind of like techniques and that those kind of ideas when I'm learning anything today, like especially when I'm trying to learn how to play the guitar, especially if I'm going to ever be able to play anything like you, which will probably take me a whole nother lifetime. Oh, but still, I have some good practice techniques to try to, you know, to get there. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's kind of how it was.
Was there a certain roadmap laid out for you when it comes to pieces or etudes, or exercises that you have to play? Like, I don't know, Jenny's School of Velocity and then Beethoven's Third Piano? Or was it more from the educational kind of side, more like, hey, let's play this song, let's learn this song now? Or was it really like a plan for you to step by step learning certain songs?
Yeah, it was very methodical. A lot of the Juilliard training was about learning particular sets of music for a performance or a masterclass. There was always, there were always like masterclasses every couple of weeks on a Saturday. My teacher would invite all the students in, and then we would perform and play for the other students and maybe talk about the music. I'm not sure. One funny memory I have from those masterclasses is that I think I was studying a Beethoven sonata at a certain point, and I had to play it for the class, and I walked, and it was my turn to play, and I walked up at the piano. You know, it was like 10 or 15 kids and my teacher there. I walked to the piano, I was ready to start playing it, and I completely forgot how it started. Oh. I mean, it was a funny memory, but I totally forgot how it started. I memorized it, but I forgot how it started.
Oh no.
I looked at my teacher, I went, I can't remember how it starts. And then she went, dun, da, da. I went, oh, yeah. And then I played it. It's like just a moment, a funny moment, you know.
Happened to everybody, yeah.
Right, right. You know, you learn a lot from these kind of experiences.
Yeah. And are there still any, I don't know, songs or etudes, pieces, exercises that you're practicing today back from that time?
Not that formally. Like every now and then I'm like, you know what, I really should be playing some Bach thing or whatever, and I'll go and I'll study that. But my life is, you know, it's so busy with whatever. Like now I'm working on a new album, solo album, and I'm in the studio a lot, and I'm still playing a lot, but I'm not really having enough time. Right. I have to practice my guitar, you know, exercises as well, so I don't have much time for, you know, going back to the classical studies. Although my wife was telling me the other day that she wanted me to learn one of the Chopin etudes that she had heard. She was like, you should play that. I was like, okay, I'll try. You know.
This is a hard process for you when you would try to face to learn Chopin etude nowadays, or is it something that is so natural for you nowadays that you could play something like that in, I don't know, a week or something like that?
Well, Chopin etudes are notoriously really, really hard. So yes, it is hard. The one she was talking about was the C major etude, which is just a ridiculous, it's like arpeggios, but the hand is really stretched out very far. Mm. So you're like playing, like, you know, like from the bottom up, you're playing like C, G, C, E, ba, 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 and you're doing that one octave, then the other, and you're, so you're reaching like a big interval, and you're, and all the chords are kind of like that. So yeah, I'd love to say, oh yeah, that's easy for me, but that's a bitch, you know, no matter who you are, really.
Yeah, I mean, you had to face those kind of difficult pieces or section, especially in the early days. Did you have a specific approach how to conquer those kind of sections? And is there a particular one that you can still remember that was quite difficult or even frustrating?
I remember I would go, like, there was a, back in those days, there were more like stores where you can go and you could buy like, classical music, sheet music, and all that stuff. And, I'd go to Juilliard like one day, and then we'd be driving back home. And on the way, we'd pick up whatever music my teacher would assign to me. And I remember very well, like literally buying like a Franz Liszt, like a Book of Hungarian Rhapsodies, I think they were called, bringing it home and looking at it, thinking that this just looks like so many crazy dots on the page. In my mind, it just looked like all these dots. And I was like, what is this? And I would say, okay, well, I got to learn this, And I would say, all right, first I'll learn the right hand, go very slowly and figure out, because a lot of these pieces have like five sharps or flats or tons of, crazy stuff. So I'd be like trying to do it and get so frustrated. I just pound the piano and go, fuck, it's not, it's so hard, So, it's, I think that I can understand why a lot of people don't reach higher levels of technical abilities or even musical abilities, because, people out there think that there's some kind of magic that's going on. Like it's just like, oh, they waved a magic wand, over Justin's head, and then he's like playing like this,
No,
Well, you and I know that, okay, maybe there's a little bit of that, but a lot of it is just taking the time and going through the mechanics and really looking at it and figuring out, what am I doing? Like, what are ways that I can get from this point to that point? And it can be very painful because it doesn't just happen. I don't care who you are, it doesn't just mysteriously on these instruments, guitars, pianos, trumpets, violins, cellos. There's too many mechanical things to deal with. Like, I was showing somebody, well, somebody showed me, but then I was showing somebody something mechanical on the guitar. Like mechanical, I mean like a new technique, like the kind of like selective picking thing that I was learning from my friend Giuseppe the other day. And it was like you play a few notes without the pick, and then you add a couple. It was like, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And I did a video, and like, it's not that hard, but when he showed it to me, I was like, what? Like, what is the timing of that? Like, oh, I need to hit with my fingers harder, and then I need to hold my finger. It's like you have to figure out the synchronization of it. And even though at first it's like, wow, that's like impossible, but then you do it, all of a sudden, slowly but surely, go, oh, okay, I got it. I got it. And I was showing it to another friend who's like a classical guitar player who was interested to see what I was doing. And although he can play the classical guitar very well, he was like, it was so foreign, that particular sound, that you could tell that was frustrating. You'd have to sit and learn this new thing, this new mechanical thing. So there's no, I'm here to say the kind of like the bad news to all the musicians, out there, people who are learning the guitar or the piano, the violin, whatever instrument you're playing, that there's no real shortcut. Like I've been kind of lucky because for whatever reason, I like to practice. I like the focus of it. Yes, I'll get frustrated and I'll go, damn it. And I'll be like, like I'm trying to learn right now, like a new challenge is I'm playing some more acoustic guitar, and kind of like tremolo, da -da 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 -da
Oh,
-da. You
God.
guys do, and I'm like, how the hell are you doing that? Like, I had a friend over last night who's a really good player. He's like, da -da 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 and I'm like, what? Let me look at your hand. Let me see, like, what is going on? How come it you make it seem so easy? So, like, for me to do that, I want to learn that. So what am I going to do? I feel a little frustrated because it's so hard, but I'm going to sit and I'm going to, turn on the metronome, and I'm going to have different ways to practice it and look at it as deeply as I can. I hope to get, some results. I don't know what'll happen. Sometimes I wonder, okay, well, I'm not a kid anymore, so maybe certain things might be harder than other things to learn. But at the same time, I'm discovering And at least I'm hearing feedback from people with a different perspective that maybe my guitar journey over the last couple of years is producing some, you know, results, even though it's hard for me to get a perspective every day. But I sit every day and I'm practicing and I'm playing and I'm trying things. I'm playing legato. I'm practicing string skipping with the pick. I get tips from guys like you to try this, try that. And I try it all. And I think that maybe it's a little too like spread out, but you know, I'm an adult with a lot of things on my plate and I'm trying so many different things, but I think I'm happy to report that by spending the time and at least doing, you know, this like every day and almost like relaxing into the practice sessions and just kind of saying, okay, I'm here with the guitar and I'm going to do this arpeggio and I'm going to feel it and look at it, and that there's some, you know, there is some improvement that is taking place.
Yeah. I truly believe that it's really helpful when you love the process of practicing and when you're really liking it and enjoying it. Nothing is harder than forcing yourself into something, into getting better. You have to really want it and you really have to love it. And there's something, this is maybe a gift where we can really appreciate and be happy about this, that we are loving this kind of process. But maybe everyone has to find his individual way how to love this kind of process of getting better.
I do think that we need to be grateful for the fact that there's some personality trait that allows us to sit and get through that challenge of learning something new. There's a desire, you know, first of all, there's a patience factor. There's a lot of things that go into it. But I think that, you know, one of the things to consider when you play music and you're trying something is you're always looking to make a good sound. No matter what it is. Like I realized the other day that something very, very basic in my guitar playing was totally missing. And you'll probably laugh because it's so basic and it's funny because it shows that my path has been not very common. But I was just playing some basic chords, like a C chord, right? Mm-hmm. Standard C chord. And then I was realizing that half the time when I'm playing it, my index finger was touching the bottom string.
Yeah.
What is going on? And I'm looking at my finger. I'm thinking, well, my fingers are pretty thin, you know, like what, why? Like people with bigger fingers are playing this chord and not having that issue.
Yeah.
So it was one of these like frustrating moments. I'm thinking, what do I have to do to make this so when I hit that chord, it doesn't mute a string? Mm. I'm looking at it. And then I spoke to a couple guitar players and I'm like, oh, you have to make sure that this part of your hand is not touching the guitar. It's more that you're coming below it, you know. And so after I looked at it and after I spent some time, because I really wanted to figure this out, I wanted to get over this challenge, and I'm starting to. Oh, okay. Well, a classical guitar player has his, maybe his knuckles that are like parallel with the fretboard, and you know, everybody's saying don't hold the guitar like that, you know, have the fretboard, hold it more like this.
Yeah.
So, yeah, after looking at it, I go, okay, well, it's not impossible.
No,
it is a little challenging, but you know, many people can play the C major chord and not, you know, have it sound messed up. So, you know, guitar is, you know, continues to be a little bit mysterious to me on some levels.
But yeah, you're 100% right that the value behind practicing is often because in the end the sound that we get out of our instrument. And some people are sometimes telling me like, oh, you're a little bit over exaggerating with practicing and nobody will notice this little detail. And maybe the listener will not point the finger on that detail, but I truly believe that subconsciously the listener will find something better when you have more control as a musician and more awareness about what you're doing, you know?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay, then coming back to your career a little bit, because with your late teens, you discovered the beautiful world of the synthesizer. Did you have to change your point of view and your approach to the instrument a lot? Or could you transpose easily your skills and the abilities that you had learned so far as a classical piano player to that other instrument?
Yeah, great question. The first synthesizer that had a tremendous effect on me was my Minimoog, which is actually kind of right behind me, right there.
Okay. Is it the original from back in the day?
It's an original Minimoog. Yeah, my original one, but it is an original Minimoog, which is probably of all the many keyboards I have, it's probably the most valuable one. Mm-hmm. But when I got it, First of all, I was so turned on by the whole electronic kind of sound. And when I realized that you could actually bend the pitch of a press a key and bend the pitch, I was like, oh my God, that's amazing. Because, you know, my whole life had been just playing the piano, and, you know, you play a note and that's it. You know, there's no vibrato or pitch. So that was like a big awakening. Plus the fact you could press a key and turn a dial. To me, that was, you know, even though the early days people say, oh, the synthesizers weren't expressive because, you know, dynamics or whatever, I was like, I didn't agree with that at all. I was like, man, I can go, like, even though the key is not necessarily doing anything, my left hand on all the knobs was doing a whole lot of expressive, cool things that you couldn't do on like a piano. So that argument, even back then, of the electronic music, you know, the instruments are not expressive, never really worked for me. And of course, today it's even more of a, the amazing things you can do with expression and touch, and some of the instruments that I play, like the Osmos or the Seaboard or Continuum. Anyway, so when I discovered the Minimoog and all that magic, I learned that there was some very basic technical things that I could grow from by using the synthesizer and the envelopes of the sound in interesting ways. Like if I set the sound to go like brown, brown, and have the decay of the sound very quick, I could make it so that if I played detached, you know, non-legato, then I could have bow, 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 bow. But if I wanted to go da 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 really fast and play a scale, I would need to lift up a little bit in between. I couldn't play legato, otherwise it would be like dun, and you wouldn't even hear the other notes.
Ah, I see.
So I would play with the envelopes of the sound to develop my technique. I'd have it be a very quick decay on the sound. And therefore, if I wanted to practice my detached playing, I would really hear when I produced the note on every note. Or if I wanted to practice legato, if I didn't play legato, I would be like, dun, dun, and like, ah, no. So I really used it to my benefit with all these new modes I found out about.
Beautiful. So let's continue our time travel journey to the year 1999, where you joined a band called Dream Theater. Maybe some of the viewers have heard from this, from that band. back in the day when you joined Dream Theater, did you have to step up your game as a keyboard slash piano player a lot to be able to play with these other incredible musicians? Or was it more like a natural fusion for you of your classical origin and the rock and metal side of music?
I think they had to step up their game. No, I mean, let me be real. You know, my bandmates are incredibly talented. You know, I'm teasing really, but one thing that attracted me about Dream Theater was that when I heard this kind of virtuosity, when somebody turned me on to them before I joined the group, I was like, wait a minute, I never hear that in rock musicians. That's like a classical thing to me, like da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, super tight, so precise, so executed so beautifully. I was like, this is incredible to me. I never heard rock music played like that. So that's the first thing that attracted me to Dream Theater, right? So when I joined, the group, you know, it was great to work with musicians in the rock vein that were so, you know, kind of like aware of being precise and technique and executing things the way that I was kind of brought up to do. So I just, you know, I just learned a lot from hanging out with the guys who had a lot of, you know, I hadn't had that kind of experience. Dream Theater, those guys started when they were very young in the scene, making music, playing concerts and getting a career going. And I was kind of like, you know, going through this process of being a classical musician and then discovering synthesizers and leaving and being a little lost and figuring and doing all kinds of different things, trying to figure out how all these pieces in my mind could come together. So when I joined Dream Theater, there's a lot of things to learn, way beyond like musical things, just like what's it like touring around the world and, you know, and kind of having this international career and what's a tour bus like and how do you even run your life, you know, when you're on tour so much in the studios. There was so many parameters to learn. And plus the fact that we were you know, starting to make some really good music, because the first album that we did was called Scenes from a Memory. It was very enjoyable process. It was a big album for a lot of people and kind of was a big step in my development. So I learned a lot of things about like how to orchestrate around a big guitar sound. Because, you know, Petrucci's guitar sound is as big as, you know, the house. It's huge, and often it's double tracked and it sounds incredible. Mm-hmm. How does a keyboard even fit into that? And I think he learned a lot, you know, we always do, because there's, you know, the rock sounds are can be so massive. You know, I've got a tremendous string sound and he's got a plong sound. And it's like, how do all those frequencies even survive? So rather than like technical things, you know, in my learning process from Dream Theater, was more about, okay, I've got a keyboard technique from my classical studies. I've got all these musical ideas, but how do we make this music, this combination of people really work and be really effective and sound as high level, as musical, enjoyable as possible? A lot of lessons in there, you know, that were definitely learned. I think I way over orchestrated the Scenes from a Memory album. There's parts that people have never even heard.
Okay, really?
I'm sure some people would want to. Maybe they're probably online somewhere, you know how the world works. But we ended up going back. You know, my feeling is like, oh, I'll add a string part. Oh, I can add French horns. Oh, I can add a little bell sound. And the guys were like, I don't know. Like, we might not need that many things, you know, just play the piano part. You know, like, I'm like, okay. You know, I'm learning what fits in, what works. Yeah. And, you know, so it's a lot of that kind of stuff.
So we speak about living the musician life as a touring musician, and especially with Dream Theater, you have long tours with really long set lists up to more than 3 hours at a certain point of your career with really difficult songs. Do you have any routines for being on tour, being fit from your mind and from the fingers to be able to perform on that level every day? Are there any learnings where you realized, okay, I have to do this or that, or avoiding these kind of things to keep up that level?
There's a lot of things, a lot of learning processes in that whole like operation, if you will. One of the major things is, well, learning, because the music is so loud, you know, with the rock music, it's very forceful. We're wearing in-ear monitors. So, you know, I'm hitting the keyboard, and then what I'm hearing is the whole band at a pretty loud volume, because it's got to be loud, because you want the in-ear mix to be over the over the weird sound you're hearing from standing in back of the PA. So it's loud. So what I'm getting to is the balance between what energy you're putting out. Like when I hit the keyboard and what comes back is something to really understand and get used to. It's not like me sitting in my room, and if I walked over to the piano and I just played a chord and I'd hear it very clearly and I'd hear the volume in the room of exactly what kind of amplitude response was coming from my hands. Nice. Here, the amplitude of what I'm playing is on a knob and it's mixed in with everybody else. So what I learned in the first part of my career with Dream Theater is that, hey, you know, be careful, because I remember, although I don't have a lot of hand problems because of my background, I'm pretty good with my hands. But at a certain point, I started to feel some really weird stuff going on in my hands. And I figured it out is that the energy, the intensity, the audience, it was encouraging me to play like really forcefully. And I was hitting the keys much harder than I really needed to. It wasn't about I needed to do that for the sound. I was almost like saying, okay, you want energy? Here it is, you know, dun, dun, and doing this and pushing into the keys and maybe getting tight. And like, you know, I'm sure as a guitar player, because now my experience with guitar is like, man, you cannot, if you start picking the strings like that, you'll sound like crap and you won't be able to do it. Well, on the keys, if you hit the key, it doesn't matter as much, because it's electronics that are going to make the sound. I can go like this and bang it. It'll still maybe sound like a very lovely sound. If you do that on a guitar, you're fucked. It's not going to work. So, but I had to learn it from a keyboard perspective, okay, there's 50,000 people there. That's fine. All good. I'm going to be able to not overplay. I'm going to have some control here and just keep my hands and my emotions and my nervous system intact. So that was a big lesson to, okay, you don't always have to like push so hard. It's important to relax. The other part of that lesson, which I think is important to mention since we're talking about practicing, which is a major theme that I present to my friends and musicians who are learning, is that, yes, many of us, we sit and practice so diligently. We learn things, we get ready for shows, we're repeating, we're getting the mechanics together. What often happens for a lot of people is you do all that and then you walk on the stage and then it's like, damn it, what happened? Where did I could do this. I just did this 2 hours ago at home and now I'm standing up in front of you 50 people and it's not happening. And why is it not happening? It's not happening because when you're standing in front of 1, 10, 50, 1,000, 50,000 people, there's pressure on your nervous system. People are watching you. There's a psychological thing that's going on that can mess with your head. So if you practiced, 4 hours a day playing this incredible arpeggio and you got it at home, it doesn't mean that when you're in front of all those people, it's going to sound like that. You could literally be at half the level that you were, at home. Mm. How do you get over that? Well, I think that the way to get beyond that is to not only practice the mechanics of the riff you're trying to play, but to practice how you want to feel when you're playing it. What is the headspace when you go? Yeah, you learn that. But now, where is your mind at? Where is your breathing at? Where is your body at? I suggest to practice that. Practice, remember how you feel when you play it. Like if I'm going, oh, there's this fluidity, almost like you want to close your eyes and breathe and go, okay, when I'm standing up in front of all the people, I'm going to get back to this headspace, not just get back to the thing that I learned, because if you do that and forget about your mind, you're going to get tense. Your hands are going to get cold or they'll get sweaty and you'll be screwed. So this is, over the last couple of years, this is what I realized is kind of a major important thing for me to express to people, because I think it really works. And it works for me, in all the different situations, finally kind of figured it out to a point.
Wow. That's super, super interesting. Yeah. And I speak from an experience when I say that the playing Dream Theater songs, especially live, is not that easy, because I tried to form a Dream Theater tribute band a few years ago. And I even got to a point with especially at Music University, where we played songs like Rotomania live, Dance of Eternity live, and all this kind of stuff. But it was a long way to get to that point with these members to play those songs. So a question that a lot of Dream Theater fans, or we Dream Theater fans, talk about is, how often do Dream Theater have band practice or band rehearsals?
Oh, yeah, right. Well, I have to say that in my experience in the professional world, it's not a lot of practice. It's not like you go, oh, guys, not like.
Like going, every week, every Saturday, band rehearsal.
I don't expect to see the guys for a while, until we're ready to go into the studio. And then even when after we've written the new album and we're getting ready to go on tour, a lot of the work is done at home.
Yeah.
So I'll practice, I'll be able to play my parts. I'll do all my, much of my kind of like mechanical work and my figuring out which parts I need to learn how to breathe, because they might be especially hard. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll practice standing on one leg and almost balancing while I'm doing something mm-hmm. ridiculous, just to make sure I can get back to that space. And then I get together with the guys. And at that point, maybe it was different playing a part, because, when the real drummer's in the room, it's throwing you off that he's hitting the hi-hat on the mm-hmm. end of something. You didn't really hear that when you were working against the recording. And so there's something to work, there's more to work out. But those things are, okay, we'll work those things out. And then we'll also bring in our production and the lights and all the stuff and work out how we want to go between songs. But a lot of the basics of being able to play through a song is done before I walk in the room. I'll have all my songs programmed. If I need some kind of like charts, I have them in my iPad. I have all the switches of sounds ready to go. And I'm basically in a good place to get the final things together with the guys.
Because I can truly imagine that especially it's not only you guys playing those songs, but there's a lot of performance in those live shows as well, especially like you going to the guitar and all this kind of stuff and getting to through all these kind of very of all this kind of yeah situations. Like for example, when I remember correctly, on Fatal Tragedy from the shows that you played a few years ago, where you played the whole Scenes from a Memory record, that it, in the end, it's like just one bar or two bars. You have time to jump from your keyboard to the guitar and rocking the Polynesian together with John, all this kind of stuff. Aren't you afraid that something like that can go wrong live?
Well, some of these things are rehearsed with our techs. Like, with the guy, if my tech needs to throw the guitar on me at a certain beat, those are the things we need to work out, you know. Yes, I know how to play the part, but then I have a discussion with, you know, my tech, and I say, hey, okay, this section, we have three beats to do it. I'm going to turn, it's like choreograph. I'll turn around, put the thing on me in that beat, and then move down. So there are certain things that happen like that where it needs to be choreographed. Some of the things that are like choreographed like that are actually done as we go. I mean, it's not the best way to do it, because you'd think on day one, you're doing your first show, everything has to be together. But, you know, the reality of it is that how much time, you know, we're talking about budget, we're talking about people's schedules, how much time can we really spend? We can't have the have our manager book us in an airplane hangar for 2 months or a month. You know, it would just be prohibitive on so many levels. So we spend, you know, a week or something like that, and we say, okay guys, the first 3 days are band rehearsals, we'll iron out all the kinks here, and the next 3 days, whatever, we're going to work with our lighting and our sound guy, and we'll, you know, set up in one of the theaters and just kind of figure out what we're doing. But that does mean that yes, we'll be able to walk on stage for the first show and we're good, but then there's always some things where we go, oh, you know what, it'd be cool if we had a better transition between those songs, and John will say, Jordan, can you make a cool drone sound or whatever? So while I go change the guitar, we realize that maybe there's a little funny gap. We're very aware of all the little moments and stuff like that, but we're not like U2 or something like that, where we can sit, you know, for a month or, you know, whatever, and just work out everything, you know, before the first show.
Yeah. To close this kind of Dream Theater chapter here and continue with generally speaking about practicing, one last question is, can you remember, what would you say was the biggest musical, so musically speaking, challenge for you in your Dream Theater career so far?
The biggest musical challenge?
Yeah. Like a certain record or a certain arrangement or a section?
Well, we'll laugh at what was the biggest challenge for me. One of the biggest challenges is when we went to record Train of Thought.
Okay.
And everybody, there's a lot of people who really love that album, and I get it. I really think that it's a good album as well. It was really challenging for me, but not because of what you think, but because we were set up in a rehearsal room. We were hashing it out in a rehearsal.
Yeah, that's this documentation.
And you know, there's something about like guitars and keyboards. Like I could have like tremendous speakers in back of me, like really big speakers to play my keyboard, and like the guitar player could have like a pig nose amplifier, and somehow I don't know why, but why is it always louder? Like, like the guitar is just always louder than, it doesn't matter what equipment I could bring in. I could bring in my own big PA and the guitarist has a little thing, but it was difficult for me because I wasn't used to like that kind of thing. I operate really well in controlled environments. I'm mostly like a keyboard guy, let's face it. So, you know, the idea of just going, rah, rah, okay, let's try this riff, guys. Bang, smash, boom. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm losing my mind. You know, so yeah, that was really, really challenging. That's not the answer like you were thinking, but to me, that was
a super interesting answer. Yeah, I did not expect that.
right. Funny story.
So one of the biggest learning for me when I'm practicing was to, and especially in the last couple of years, was to not only practice something, but like you've mentioned it already, to get an awareness of what you're doing in your hands and in your fingers and in the music itself. And what helped for me a lot is to record and to film myself. Especially with my iPhone have the slow motion function, and there I can clearly see how certain picking stuff is working and finger stuff. How did you get this awareness, especially you coming from a time where these kind of technology did not exist yet? How did you get this awareness about your playing, and how important is that for you?
Yeah. Well, I had an amazing teacher who was like very much into the fundamentals of technique. How do you hold your hand? How do you, like, I would be playing scales. My teacher would come over, and as I ascended the scale, she'd literally take me by the elbow and could pull me along like a little bit faster than I would normally go. So if I'm going like, she would like, and it would almost allow me to feel this motion. Like, I'm sure you've heard this, like you're practicing like an arpeggio or a guitar pattern, and you go, da 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 da. Da-da-da-da. You know, there's one way to practice it is where you go dun 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 slowly, but there's also another way to practice where you kind of like burst, you know,
yeah,
like
yeah.
You aim to the note, you just feel what it's like to get through it, you know. So a lot of techniques like that, although I didn't have like video cameras and stuff like that, I had a teacher kind of like, you know, always like on me and not allowing me to fall into any like bad kind of like habits, and also studying things like independence of the fingers. Like, you know, I would be learning from like the Phillips book of hand independence and really focusing on like, okay, you hold your hand like this, and now I want to, you know, lift up these three fingers, and I want to like trill between these while holding these down, and all kinds of, you know, interesting things. And my teacher would come over and I'd be lifting up this finger, and which is a weaker finger, but she'd be like, try a little higher, you know, a little higher, you know, just to really get it to go down. So it was all things like that. Or even like in my later years, I realized, okay, well, I learned basic, you know, kind of like independence to be able to do things like that. But then what about like doing things like where you use rhythmic ideas to make sure that your fingers are even? So I'm holding all my fingers down, right? And then I can go like between these two. That's fine that I can do that. But what about having like a triplet kind of a rhythm, like da 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 da.
Accenting, accepting one or the other.
Yeah, all of a sudden, it's not only the challenge of lifting these up without lifting these up. Mm. Now it becomes you want to accent, yeah. Accent, accent, and you don't want to do it like, you know, you don't get your whole arm involved. My teacher was like, "No, hold your arm, hold your hand like straight, you know, and then use your fingers to create the accent." So. I was able to gain a lot of like, you know, individual strength in my fingers. So I could trill with these, or I could trill with these, or I could even kind of like trill with these, or things like, you know, my teacher would be like, okay, you're playing da 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 da. Well, you know, these fingers are the weaker ones, so spend a little more time on that. So my scale practice would end up being like da 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 da. But these things make total sense. Like your fingers are strong. These are weaker. So yeah, spend more time on that. So when I'm practicing the guitar, I'm thinking the same thing. I'm going, well, I'll go da 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 da. Maybe I'll practice pulling off between these, or just seeing how much sound I can make without the pick, or tapping and getting sound. So that's why I'm learning better how to create some equality between my fingers, because I'm kind of conscious of that, you know, that idea where these fingers are weaker, so you're going to spend more time and work on those, you know. So it's a lot of I really use all the things I learned in my piano technique towards my goal of getting better on the guitar, and hoping that, you know, those things apply. I think a lot of them
definitely,
do.
Definitely,
you know?
Yeah. So, speaking about that, and especially after you've mentioned that your teacher used to pull your arm into a certain direction, this is something that you cannot imagine of doing it by a guitar teacher, because guitar education is often more like, do whatever you feel comfortable with and don't force yourself into something. And now you have a perspective on this instrument, the guitar, which is kind of unique, because coming from this really traditional classical point of view on from your piano side, and now comparing guitar, rock education, piano, classical education, is there for you a difference, or is this something that you wish classical education got learned from rock education and vis-a-vis?
Well, one of the challenges of learning the guitar is that when you talk to guitarists, most of them are like, well, you know, whatever's comfortable, like you can do, you can play like that, or you can hold your hand like that, you can do this. And I don't believe that totally. Mm-hmm. I believe that somebody, you know, like you or like some of my friends that has a higher level technique, there's certain roadblocks. You know, if you're playing this way and your hand is your elbows way up in the air or something like that, I honestly don't believe that you'll be able to get that far down the road. I mean, yeah, like people will point to this guy or that guy. Well, he plays really weird. And look, he can do it. Mm. You know, so there's not the kind of like history or background in the guitar world that dictates that if you want to get these results, hold the pick like this and, you know, do this. And like, there's not so much detailed, concrete, like proven information there. So it makes it a little harder. It makes it harder for guys like me, because I'm like, somebody just tell me like how I should be practicing. Like, is it okay that I'm holding my hand like this? Is it okay that my wrist is in this position? Like that's made it the process maybe a little slower, because, you know, like one of the challenges I still have is that when I played one of this beautiful Kiesel guitar that the company sent me, like if I'm picking the way I pick and my hand is where it goes, I'm pressing, like all of a sudden it sounds out of tune because like,
yeah, because of the front notes, really,
it's in a bad spot. The what's it called? The tremolo or the bridge.
The tremolo, yeah.
It's in a bad spot for me and the way I play. I don't know if it's mostly like I really should have learned a different way, or maybe this guitar needs an adjustment, or I don't know, but I can't really play that guitar much as nice as it is. Because every time I play it, I'm like, fuck, I can't, like, it's, you know, it's like ridiculous. So maybe someday you'll tell me, well, Jordan, that's because, you know, you really should be holding your wrist higher when you pick or something like that. Or I don't know. Anyway, that's a point that I was making. But now that I'm learning a little bit about like a classical kind of technique with, I'm doing some finger picking things, those guys are more specific. Yeah. Some of my friends are like, oh no, you hold the guitar and you can't like turn, you can't have your wrist like this. And you shouldn't have your wrist down on the guitar when your pitch should be up. And there should be a little curve and it can't be bent. It's got to be natural. And then, you know, all these kind of, and you rest your weight. And I'm like, oh, I feel like, wow, I can relate to that more. Even though that's really hard, you know, I can kind of relate to that kind of thinking where, okay, we're developing a proven kind of like technique, because if you do it this way, that will get you the mileage to get far. But if you hold your wrist here and your finger is bent and you don't put your weight on it, you're not going to go very far.
Well, I think in the piano world, there is this kind of experience, this experience that goes back to, I don't know, 200, 300 years of teachers and educators showing how to play better. And I truly believe that currently we are in some sort of movement of guitar educators where a lot of people are a little bit more like this, like really strict and saying, okay, when you want to reach a certain tempo with your picking, I always say pick out of your wrist, not out of your arm and all this kind of stuff.
To a certain
point, I would say that is something which is general and then starts some individual habits. But sometimes I have the feeling, and now on this is my next question, that certain people are getting lost in this kind of detail and then practicing so much that they are losing maybe the sense of being musically and just practicing for the practice purpose. What would you recommend to somebody like that? So or how do you combine practicing your instrument but still being creative or making music?
Yeah, great question. It's really important to be musical when you're working, otherwise it can get very, very boring. But being musical, like, you know, there's a lot of guitar players that get very criticized because they're like, oh, he's just technical, or that guy just is shredding. He never writes music. It's, you know, whatever. But let's understand that. I mean, yes, it's amazing to us to see somebody like a Petrucci that has a really, really good guitar technique, but he also has been so influential in the world of like composition and musical style. That's like perfect. Let's say that's great. That's what everybody wants, but not everybody's going to do that. And that's okay. And it doesn't mean that this guy over here that's going, that, you know, that doesn't mean that he's not that guy who can do that perfectly in time is not being musical. He's achieving an incredible, like, result, maybe exactly with a metronome, perfect rhythm right there. If he's really playing tight to the rhythm, and it's really, really clean sounding, I consider that to be amazing. And that's a musical feat, because it's not easy to make the notes sound so precisely, so clearly, and to play in time like that. So having a good technique on an instrument really to me means that you can play fast and you can also play slow. So if you're playing something really slow and the notes are sounding beautiful and your bends are smooth and the articulation is good at a very slow tempo, that's part of having a really great technique. If you can only go, but when you're playing something expressive and it's like somehow it's not flowing properly, it doesn't sound smooth in that regard because you're tense or you're jerky or there's something interrupting the flow of the articulation, well, then that prevents the music from happening. So the music to me is about this kind of almost like rhythmic, kind of natural kind of energy towards producing the sound. That's why I have a lot of respect for the guys who can, if it's in time, if it's clear, if it's precise, I'm like, wow, that's amazing. Whether or not they can ever write a note of music in their lives, well, we don't know. But we do know that they've achieved something really cool. And that might be very important to them that they can do that. It might have been a big hurdle to get beyond that. And I really respect that. Will that person be my number one, you know, musician, guitar player? No, because maybe they don't write any music and I don't maybe even like their music, but I will respect it and I will consider that to be in a musical space, you know? So, and when you're practicing, I think it's really important, like Andy Wood just told me when we were talking at his guitar camp, he's like, think about the tone, you know, don't just think about the picking really fast. Think about what is the sound you're making? Like if you think about the sound you're making, that's half the battle. So you never get ahead of yourself. You're never going and making a crappy sound. If you should be playing slower than that, if you can't make a good sound, you're trying to make a good sound, and that's a musical thing right there. That kind of thinking really resonated with me, because I'm always about like, okay, you know, if you're going to play the piano, you don't have a super technique, but you can still go over to it and make a nice sound, even if you can only play in the key of C major. Go to it. Think about the sound in your mind that you want to hear, and then press the notes down at the piano. What do they sound like? You know, so the art of developing a technique or getting into a practice system, if you keep these things in mind, it can remain musical. Don't forget about rhythm. You know, if you're just practicing, that's not that helpful. But if you put on a drum groove or a beat of some sort or a metronome, God forbid a metronome, then you're gonna da 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 da, and you can start to feel the rhythm and the feel of that, of staying when you lock in and settle into the groove. That's when the music begins. That's when you're like, you know, become one with the groove and the rhythm and the feel. And you know, thinking along those lines, I think will help people to make their practice sessions more of an experience that is in the range of music, you know?
Yes. Awesome. That's a really great point of view. John, thank you really, really a lot of times for being on this channel and making this interview happen, learning a lot out of your wisdom words from the wisdom wizard, the piano wizard. It was really great to have you here. And let me just say thank you again as well. I would say I speak for a lot of my viewers to say thank you for your music and the stuff that you do from Dream Theater. A lot of people would not play the instrument like they're playing it, and I would not sit here and do this if there wouldn't be your music and Dream Theater. So a lot of thanks, of course, for that. And yeah, so much about this really cool interview. Thanks for being here. Thanks for sharing your wisdom. And I would say, subscribe to this channel, leave a like and leave a comment, the usual clickbaity stuff at the end.
Let me also say thanks to you for having this, because this is a really important discussion.
Yes.
I appreciate your perspective and feedback about all of it too, because you're a really good practicer and a good player. And, you know, to talk about this type of reality stuff with somebody is, you know, I think really helpful to everybody out there. So, you know, and I really thank also all the people who, you know, kind of give the energy and support to listen to the music I've made over the years. It's sometimes hard for me to get a real true perspective of the influence that people tell me that, you know, that Dream Theater and I've had over them. It's a little hard to like kind of comprehend from my little world here, but I appreciate it. And it helps me to kind of have the strength to keep on, you know, making it happen and doing it. So thank you, everybody. Thanks for having me on your show. And I wish you all the best for it.
Yeah, me too, to you. And see you soon, Jordan. Goodbye.
Okay, my friend. Great.
Bye-bye.
Bye.